Let's see. What time is it? 1:40, and it's April 11th. Seems like we were just here, Mr. Co-Chairman.
Sure seems like.
And for the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Representative Kelly, Co-Chair Schnault, myself, Co-Chair Meyer, Vice Chair Stolt, Representative Jewell, and Representative Hawker. On this afternoon's schedule, we have we're going to pick up House Bill 93. I think that's where we left off last time we met. And then go on to House Bill 485, House Bill 447, House Bill 475. And if there was any confusion at all, the bill, what's your bill number, Representative Stoltz? 390? 390 will be tomorrow morning. So if there's anybody here on for 390, House Bill 390 is tomorrow. Okay, so let's go on to House Bill 93. If the sponsor wants to join us. We adopted a blank committee substituted document. The sponsor staff introduced the bill to us, and we were just, I think, getting started on public testimony. Does that sound right?
That's right. Chair, for the record, he's related staff Representative Anderson. The staff or the sponsor doesn't have anything further to add at this point in time. I went over the work draft that you had adopted, and I believe that we have Mr. David Logan from the Alaska Dental Society, who is here physically present. Off net is George Schaefer and Jim Toll, who is the executive director of the Alaska Dental Society. I believe also Mr. Urian from the division is here. So with that, I will let you move on with your work.
All right. Well, let's just go right on into public testimony then. And let's see. I have on this schedule, and I'll check to make sure if you're here and not on the schedule that we get to you. Let's go to Dr. Robert Robertson. I think he's offline. Okay. Dr. Robertson, are you with us, or are you doing a root canal?
Yes, sir, with you. I was in between the hospital taking my mom and home. I was here, past president, or past chairman of the Board of Dental Examiners, past president of the Dental Society, to answer any questions you may have. So I'll just wait and see if I can answer questions.
Okay. Appreciate you being with us, Dr. Robertson.
It's Jimi Hendrix.
Okay, let's now go on to
Dr. Robertson said he would
be available for questions if we have any. Okay, let's go now to George Schaefer.
Okay, am I online?
Let's see. Do we have
Dr. Schaefer? Okay, go ahead, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, director, my name is George Schaefer. I'm a dentist practicing in Ketchikan. I've also been a past dental licensing board president and president of the Dental Society. I'd like to make just a couple brief comments about the purpose for this bill. And the purpose for the bill, from our viewpoint, is to strengthen the action of the dental board, allowing them to deal with discipline in a more timely manner, ensuring that all of the testimony and records that are included in a complaint are able to be viewed and will continue on into the future to be viewed by the members of the board as they make a decision for discipline, unlike what was done sometimes in the past. And more importantly, we would like the board to be able to enter at an earlier stage when complaints from patients are more benign, rather than have to wait until there's serious injury or harm to patients before the board is able to take action. So having said that, I would also just like to stay online and be able to answer questions if there are any.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Had a little technical difficulty today. Jim Dow.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's Jim Toll.
Toll.
For the record, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Dental Society. I am here in Anchorage really as a backup you have the benefit of Dr. Schaefer's comments, Dr. Robinson and Dr. Logan, and I will attempt to answer any questions that they can't handle. With that, in respect for the committee's time, I'll simply be available to answer questions.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Tao. Is there anybody else who is online that wanted to testify? If not, I do have some here in Juneau. Okay, let's go on to David Logan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Dr. Logan?
Dr. Logan, yes. I'm a dentist here in Juneau, and like my colleagues, I'm also a past president of the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners and a past president of the Alaska Dental Society. I'd like to echo Dr. Schaefer's comments on 93. I think that it serves some valuable features for the board. It will establish peer review, a feature we do not have on the dental board right now. It will allow the board to use its expertise on dental matters. Currently, the system has the board as the final arbitrator for dental complaints, but they don't often get a chance to use, at least collectively, their expertise on dental matters as the process moves along. Typically, only one board member is utilized, two now under the current system, and those have to recluse themselves from the case as it moves through, somewhat limiting their ability to use their expertise along the way. 93 would also give the public a chance to bring more cases to the board than the board is currently seeing. As it stands right now, a case has to reach the level of having some fairly major implications before the resources are allowed to kind of move forward and to tackle the cases. 93 would allow the smaller cases, ones that might be considered now a minor matter to practitioners, but perhaps not so matter, so minor to a public person who has a complaint and would like to have an avenue to have that brought. It will also allow earlier intervention for impaired practitioners, a feature that right now has to rise to the level of actual impairing the ability to practice. And I can say from my years on the board, unfortunately, the majority of cases heard before the board do involve substance abuse. And I, like my colleagues, will be available to answer any questions that you have.
Okay, I don't have any questions. Any questions from any members? Not at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go on to Rick Urin. Okay, Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Urin. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And with all due respect to those who testified before me, I'm going to be very blunt with the one I so there's no confusion about how the department feels about the bill before you. On March 23rd and 24th of this year, just a few weeks ago, the Board of Dental Examiners met here in Juneau. Of the 8 members that were present at that board meeting, 7 of them opposed this bill. These are the people who are in charge of regulating the practice of dentistry. The one person on the board who supports the bill happens to be the president of the Dental Society. And I can tell you it was difficult for the other dentists on the board to oppose their society, but they think opposing this bill is the best thing for dentistry. I want to read to you parts of an email we received last week from a board member. This came Thursday of last week. I was at a risk management seminar today, and during the second part, two local attorneys got up and started really blasting occupational licensing about how they are out to get dentists. It was a very inflammatory presentation. We were all encouraged to contact legislators to put Hospital 93 with just that, the assurances that it would be good for us. They did not even mention the subject matter of the bill. That's the testimony you've already heard here today. They don't talk about the bill. I wonder if the attorneys want dentists to think that the bill will rid them once and for all of occupational licensing. Mr. Chairman, for those people who think that the occupational licensing is out to get dentists, let me tell you what's happened in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, there have been 195 cases. 40 of those cases were brought against two dentists. 40 of those cases were brought against two dentists. 95 of them were dismissed without action. An average of 6 cases a year with dentists with action. And this is cases from action regards maybe no, didn't get continued education, a license action, they were in their license application for license either. They failed to tell us about their problems in other states. There's lots of things to deal with dentistry that's not really significant. You've heard that we don't have peer review. We set up a new system in occupational licensing for the Board of Dentistry a year ago. We have peer review. Every case that comes before the Board of Dentistry that regards patient care goes to a two-member panel, and that panel of dentists says, you know, it's the patient went to the dentist and had this and this and this, and the dentist did this and this and this. So the dentist, the panel review says, either the dentist acted properly and it's dismissed, or the dentist acted improperly and it goes to investigation. We have that today. We are not out to get dentists, and we have a very efficient system that's a lot better than it used to be. I understand that, you know, there used to be problems long before my time, but that's not it. They say it's the time frame for their, in this bill before you, is much longer than it is today. 2 years ago, the legislature adopted a thing called the Administrative Hearing Office of Administrative Hearings. And under the rules of that, the hearing officer has to have a final decision within 120 days of the time a hearing has been requested. Under the bill before you, the Board of Dentistry does not have to make a recommendation until 180 days after the hearing is concluded. Mr. Chairman, the only reason we have licensure is for public safety. That's the only reason we have it. There is nothing in this bill before you that it deals with public safety. This bill was designed to make it confusing and more difficult to discipline bad dentists. And with that, I'll close my testimony.
Okay. Before we get into questions, let me ask you also, did you do the fiscal note on this?
No, I not me personally, no.
We do have a new fiscal note. It's changed quite a bit.
Yes, it changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I just get an opportunity to glance at that. I'm not sure it's a correct one. I think the person missed some things.
You want to speak to it, or are you saying who would be able to speak to it?
The person that did that is in my office. You know, the bill has changed considerably from the first bill to now, and admittedly the cost is down. But I think if this bill were to become law, a few years of experience would find that the cost going up considerably. The time frame for investigations is horrible under this bill before you.
Okay. And how does this differ then from what the doctors do? Don't they kind of self-regulate themselves similar to what they're proposing here?
Bill. The doctors do exactly what we do now for dentists. The doctors do exactly what we do now for dentists. That's where we started in the medical board. We did the same thing for the dentistry board. It works very well for the doctors. And believe you me, the doctors have a lot more cases against them than dentists do. A lot more. And it works very well.
I represent Schultz.
Chairman, I was looking at the fiscal note also. And the only thing that looks the same from the original to the new one is the $6,000 for travel. If we're going to institute the new program for self-policing, I'm curious as to where in the new fiscal note that the funds would come to indeed pay for those costs.
the law says that whatever it costs us to regulate the practice of dentistry is paid for by dentists. Every 2 years, we do a very accurate accounting system. We divide it by the, simply divide it by the number of dentists, and that's what the bill comes to. There'll be a lot of travel costs actually under this bill because all disciplinary hearings have to be done in person. Not telephonically, as we do in many cases.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But I think that these are all receipt paid. I mean, the dentists themselves will pay this.
That's correct. Yeah. Dentists will pay them. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Very good.
Still adds to the bottom line, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, 6,000 is a lot better than the, what was the first one? It was 212,000.
212,000.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions for Mr. Uring? Okay. Thank you, sir. I don't think I have anyone else to testify. Heath, do you want to come back up here? I think you heard the concerns of Mr. Uring. Any comments, or would you rather have?
Well, if I just can reply, yeah, briefly. Mr. Uring has been consistent in his objections. To this bill, it seems as though the concerns he's continued to outline have grown in scope and severity, and I can't comment on his position in terms of if he believes that generally to be true from the division's perspective, then I have to respect his opinion. However, we have worked with the division consistently throughout this process to make them aware of the changes we've looked at, to ask for their input, to see if there were ways that we could make this bill more amenable, and so I believe that where we're at as the sponsor is simply a difference of opinion, a difference of philosophy. We believe, as does the Alaska Dental Society, that this is ultimately beneficial. However, the division consistently remains opposed to it. So I don't, at best I can say we have consistently worked with the division, and we would be willing to do that to make this bill more amenable. But I believe that we've gotten to sort of an impasse.
Okay, very good. And why do you think this approach is better than the current?
Well, in dealing with the Alaska Dental Society, with whom the bill was crafted, the sponsor believed that the arguments that they outlined with regard to providing a better public process, and perhaps a process that would be more timely, and again, I know Mr. Uring disagrees with that. The sponsor believed those arguments to be compelling, and that's why he chose to introduce the bill.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Ripson Kill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Heath, could you just go over the differences between the models? I mean, Mr. Uring talked about the medical society model, and that the two were the same, and that the medical society model was working well, and this is a change from that. And would you just differentiate from us what you see those differences are?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, in all honesty, I'm not familiar enough with the process currently adopted by the medical board to speak with any proficiency or expertise on that. So I believe perhaps either Dr. Logan or Dr. Schaefer or Mr. Toll may be able to respond to you on that question.
Okay. So I might just follow on. Mr. Uring quoted, 7 of 8 of the folks at the meeting were against this. Is that the old board, or what's the rub there?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, my understanding is that was as a result of a meeting this March with the current board. I've seen conflicting emails. I believe that there should be an email that received this afternoon from Dr. David Eichler from North Pole, who I believe is currently a dental board member. And my understanding is the dental board took no official position. Whether or not 7 of the 8 existing members strongly oppose this bill, I cannot say, because I haven't seen the email to which Mr. Uring was referring.
for those folks, members of the...
Those, my understanding, those, the email he's referring to, they are members of the board. The society essentially is a private group. The board is regulated by the state. So these are board members who, all or some of which may be members of the dental society, but are not necessarily.
Do you know if there's a split in the society? I've received support, positive support from my area for the bill. Is there a big split out there, or you know?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, I honestly believe that Mr. Toll, the executive director of the Dental Society, would probably be best to answer that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good question, Representative Kelly. Dr. Toll, are you you online still?
I am, Mr. Chairman. It's Mr. Toll.
Toll, I'm sorry.
And I can say without hesitation there is no division within the Alaska Dental Society regarding this particular bill. And we also have, you should have an email from the administrator of the board affirming that the state board took no position on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Actually, I think, Dr. Logan, are you still here? What, if you don't mind.
Dr. Logan, I think you've been hearing some of the questions and some of the comments from
Mr. Urien. With the... I always get a little puzzled when there's two mm-hmm. sides that they both feel very strongly on their positions. Do you have any comments to add to what Mr. Urien had mentioned?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Dave Logan, I do have a few comments to make there. Mr. Urien said that seven board members opposed this legislation. I'm not entirely certain where he came with his math. I haven't talked to every board member. The four I did discuss this with all supported 93, and they certainly didn't have anybody twisting their arms when I was talking to them, so I'm not entirely sure where he came from his numbers. I can say unequivocally that the dentists in this state do not feel the board is out to get them. That's an interesting comment to make there. As a former board member, I've seen both sides of the fence, of both being somebody who is looking at the licensees, looking at trouble with licensees, and just as a practitioner in the state who's under the regulation of the board. And before I became a board member, I can't say that I ever felt that anybody on the board was out to get me. And certainly after I became a board member, I can definitely say I wasn't out to get anybody, quite the opposite. Well, I shouldn't say quite the opposite, but I think you tend to look at things from a little bit more balanced perspective when you're on the board. You try and find out a little bit more about a case, which is one of the difficulties, and one of the things that has led us to 93 is it's extremely difficult to get that information as a board member. You are considered tainted if you receive any information on an ongoing investigation before it reaches its conclusion, which makes it extremely difficult as a board member to know what exactly is happening in the investigative process. These investigations will drift along for a period of time. You receive very brief reports that say that an investigation is ongoing. It might give you as much information as saying it's regarding quality of work, but that would be the most information you would have to know. It's hard as a board member to have any feeling for what's happening during the investigative process. Is it going along in a timely fashion? Has it stalled? Is there something going on in the investigative process that has gone awry? You have absolutely no knowledge of that, and that makes it extremely difficult as the people who are supposed to regulate dentistry in the state to really make any sort of logical decisions at that point. Director Urien said that they have instituted peer review. I think what we have here is a case of semantics. The peer review he's spoken of is not peer review as it's defined by organized dentistry. Peer review for organized dentistry is when there is a board members, a small panel of
of board members that actually hear a case themselves. They hear the case, they hear the evidence brought in, they reach a conclusion, that is forwarded on to the board. It's not a full investigation by any stretch of the imagination. It's generally where minor matters would be referred to. This is the forum I spoke of earlier for public members to bring what are cases that now currently don't go into the into the system that are tend to be set aside.
Okay. I'll go ahead, Chris. Okay.
Just thank you, Doctor. As you see the dentists under 93 move away from the model that the docs and dentists have had in the past, any comment on that? Why we would see the dentists move in a different direction from what the doctors are doing, or are they having difficulties too? Or
Representative Kelly, through the chair, I don't know that I can comment directly for what's happening for the medical association. I can tell you from the perspective of the dentists, the largest current change that we're looking at under 93 would be establishing peer review. That would open up a venue that just simply isn't available right now. The other major part thrust of 93 would be that the dentists would become involved earlier in the process. They would actually, or I shouldn't say the dentists, the board, which is made up of more than just dentists, and that's probably a fact I should emphasize a little bit more. You have a makeup of dentists, hygienists, and one layperson on the board. The board would hear these matters or hear the case in a general sense a little bit earlier in the process, and they would direct which direction it would go. Would it be appropriate that it's heard from peer review? Should it go to a disciplinary committee? Should it go through a full investigative process? What level does it rise to? And I think that's something that uniquely the board is equipped to handle. As an investigator, they're extremely well trained in what they do. They do a wonderful job, but it would be analogous to a dentist throwing on a Sherlock Holmes hat and wandering out to try and conduct an investigation. As dentists and hygienists, we're no way can we conduct something like that in any sort of meaningful fashion. By the same token, I don't think that an investigator is really qualified to assess the dental end of things.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Kelly. Representative Schnell?
Oh, the more I think, the more I have questions, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Logan, Mr. Urich stated a while ago that the current setup is within 120 days of a charge, and correct me if I'm wrong, charge being brought, that a finding has to come back. And I assume that's back to the board?
Yes, that would be correct.
Okay.
The investigators would bring in their findings.
And then your concern was that board members don't know much about what's going on until you may get a blurb every once in a while saying case is ongoing, but you don't know until the 120th day that what action's been taken by the investigator.
The way the system currently works,
you would arrive at a board meeting, and at some point in the board meeting, the investigators would come in and give their report. And for a case like this that was going to a decision, would be under executive session. They would present the findings that they had come up with and recommend what they think would be an appropriate resolution to the charges brought, and you would have, at that time, the board would vote on it. You would have heard nothing about the case beforehand. Whichever board members were involved in the investigative process would have to recluse themselves from the case. And so you would be presented with the findings and a recommendation from the investigators, of which you could vote up or vote down. You did not have the option of alternate. All you could do would be to vote it down and send it back to them for further review.
And that is what the new program does.
The new program would eliminate, well, the board would be aware of the case from the outset when the complaint is brought. They would at that time direct where it would go to, what level it rises to, at least at the surface there, if investigation is needed, and if not, would it be appropriate to refer it to peer review or something else there.
once a decision is reached there, it would come back for the board for approval of the decision, or the board would then have the option to say, no, this is a little bit more serious than we originally thought. It really needs to go through more investigation.
Okay, so basically now you're not giving much information at the board level originally. But what this
mushroom.
Does, huh?
You're the proverbial okay. mushroom.
But then what this does now is this would allow you to have access to all the information to make a decision on whether the investigation goes forward or what direction that the investigation goes.
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay.
Okay.
No, I think that's it for right now.
We can come back to you.
Representative Couture.
Don't you create a due process problem, though, if all of a sudden you, who could become the ultimate decision maker, directs an investigation and directs where the case goes and how it goes? I mean, that's why you're separated now, so that you can maintain that final, you know, arbiter of the decision. Don't you run up against that problem if you start to turn into both the, you know, the the investigator and decision maker early on, and then you have to maybe sit in final decision making too? Don't you run that risk?
Mr. Chair, would it be possible for Dr. Schaefer to respond to this question? He's more of our constitutional person.
I'm fine with whomever. Right. I know I've run up against this problem as an assistant AG, and I just don't know how you get around that loop. Thanks.
Dr. Schaefer, are you still online?
Yep.
Okay. Did you hear Representative Cotula's question?
Yeah, yes, I can. Under the present system, the board operates under the Administrative Procedures Act. And the Administrative Procedures Act gives the board the ability to look at evidence early on in the process, or to refer all of the investigations to another group. In this case, it's the investigators. But when we're talking about reserving the board's independence, so that we're not tainted at the time a decision is made, there is a problem in the present system. And the present system tells the board that they cannot see evidence. You're not allowed to see an X-ray. You're not allowed to see the initial complaint. You're not even allowed to know who it is that you're making a decision about. You need to make a decision, because then if you make a decision and the person that receives discipline decides to appeal, then they appeal it to the board. The Administrative Procedures Act is very clear. The board does not sit as an appeals body, but the appeals body goes to the Superior Court. But because of the way the department has been working for many years, they're telling the board that they're sitting as an appeals body, and as a result of that, the board for many years was not given any evidence. And it's very uncomfortable to sit and make a decision about whether or not a tooth was diagnosed correctly if you're not allowed to even see the initial X-ray that's part of the evidence before you make a decision. So that's what drove us in the direction of coming up with this bill. In addition to that, Mr. Urien's testimony said that there were 40 cases against two dentists. Well, the present system doesn't allow the board to know who these dentists are, so that you can see the smoking gun and go in and check out. The board is allowed to investigate offices if they feel that something is out of the ordinary, but by not being able to do this, by not knowing who the identities are, you have maybe 20, well, in this case, 40 cases against two dentists before the board finally is able to take some action. And our bill would allow the board to get in earlier so that the public is protected at an earlier stage. So what we want to do is not really change things all that much, but to take the process and define it out of the Administrative Procedures Act, not because it's a bad act, but because if we can take it and put it in a bill, then the legislature is making it very clear how they would like this process to occur. Because there are some pretty broad areas of possible misinterpretation of the Administrative Procedures Act that are in action right now. And this is just a way to codify it so that the legislative intent is very clear by putting it into statute.
Go ahead.
Okay, just so that I understand, under the APA right now, do you ever make a decision? You do, don't you? And then that can be appealed on. Is that right?
Well, the Administrative Procedures Act says the appeal is to the Superior Court.
But
the department says the appeal is back to the department. And so we have a difference of opinion on how the Administrative Procedures Act should be interpreted.
I'm sorry. Just so that I'm clear, though, I mean, if you would be the original deciders, aren't you, though, on if somebody's license is yanked? Aren't you the original decider on that?
Well, that's correct. And those of us that are testifying in favor of the bill were on the board for a number of years where we were not allowed to see evidence. We were told by the department to take their word for it, make a decision. And then if you made a bad decision and the licensee appeals it, at that point they would allow you to see the evidence. And that's what drove us to go through the effort to try to rewrite a bill.
Well, if I might just
go
further. If at least my memory is that the AG's office would bring the evidence to the board after the investigation was complete, and then you would make your decision. And the reason for that is the taint, that if you've directed the investigation and you know the identities, then, I mean, it's like having a judge that directs an investigation. We don't want that under our system. So that concerns me. But then I was trying to ask the same question of the new system and whether you've had anybody analyze whether or not you're creating a problem for yourselves if you're going to serve as, you know, the group that sets the investigation and decides what the problem is, and then all of, you know, brings it back to yourselves to make the decision. You'll have somebody appeal that under a denial of due process at some point if it's set up that way, I think. I don't know. Have you had anybody analyze that?
Well, I can address that because the new system, as this bill represents, would have a single person, which would be the president of the board, or if the board president is not a dentist, a dentist designated by the board president would be the one that would do the triage. That person could be recused from the process. But the rest of the board members then would be able and would have the evidence in front of them if they cared to look at it at the time they make a decision. But in all the years that those of us that are testifying have been on the board, the department says, no, you can't see the evidence. You have to make a decision taking our word from the investigators that this is what we saw. But it's pretty hard to feel comfortable making a decision without seeing any evidence at all. Now, I don't have any problem with having the board president be recused because they're doing the triage. And in addition to that, within the bill, there's two committees. There's a peer review committee and a disciplinary committee. And they can be members of the sitting board, but the board can also call on other dentists to help them with the process. For example, previous board members. And they could work as a committee and do this work and then bring all of the evidence back with a recommendation. But the board, in every case in the new bill, makes the final decision with evidence at the time they make the choice.
I think I'm finally understanding what it seems that your concern is. So your concern is that when you're, as a board, making your final decision on, let's say it was a disciplinary action, that even at that point you're not getting enough information on how to make the decision. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Petula. Representative Kelly?
Just to either one of the witnesses, if we were to look at the other 49 states, how would we find them doing this?
There is huge variation, there is huge variation across the country. A lot of it depends upon the region that you visit. Most states do have the peer review process in, not all, but most. Certainly, our system of deciding cases without having full contact of the evidence is probably unique amongst the remaining 50 states, or 49 states, I would say that, without having done an exhaustive review of each state there. But of the other states that talked with examiners and so forth there, generally a look of puzzlement is what you usually get when you describe our process.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kelly. Any other questions for the folks online or Dr. Logan? Any other comments in general? Representative
Schnell. Mr. Chairman, I would make a comment. I've asked. I thought I heard earlier that the board didn't really have a position on the bill, and I would think, you know, and this is just call me, but I would think that a board that has something this important where they're going to be making all the decisions now would have a variance on the board. And I understand there's numerous people on the board, and for one reason or other, they may like part of the bill and don't like the other part. But it just strikes me as curious that the board itself doesn't have an opinion on the bill.
Chair, can I respond to that?
Sure.
At least from my time on the board was not allowed to take position on legislation. You could not informally endorse or say that legislation was bad.
Well, it was just stated, so mm-hmm. It was just an opinion.
I was real curious when I saw that information, too. I looked at that. I was like, my, things have changed.
President Robert.
The committee could request an opinion from the board. Representative Schnell.
What was that, Representative?
Ask for the board's opinion.
Nothing wouldn't prohibit that, would it?
No, I don't think anything prohibits asking them what their opinion are, and I assume that the opinion that they're going to give is their own personal opinion and not that of the board.
Okay. I think we've talked about this long enough. There's obviously two sides to every issue. We've heard both sides, I think, thoroughly. I think the sponsor, you need to do some educating of legislators before this gets to the floor, but I don't see any reason to keep this in committee any longer. Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I was going to move HB 93 out of committee with individual recommendation for the attached resolution. Yeah. I appreciate all the work that the sponsor did on this bill and the staff.
Object just for a comment. I see a lot of quizzical looks around this particular table on this one. I also have reservations about the bill, but on the other hand, I've been troubled by what I've seen as an ongoing sequence of issues taken by professions with the Division of Occupational Licensing. I know that I was approached by another professional group and asked me to write a similar bill to take them out of more into self-regulation by their board and less, you know, licensing regulation. I mean, I don't know where to go from here, but I mean, I'm a little troubled by this. We seem to have something in the state at OCC licensing that's not working. I don't know what it is, but I also worry about us making the wrong decision, a knee-jerk reaction, and perhaps passing a bill that doesn't get to what ever the root of the problem is, that I don't know what that problem is. I'm like yourself. I have no idea where I'm going on this bill, but there's just some of the whole situation that leaves me very disquieted.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure either on this bill. I guess the only barometer I've had is how many times the Director of Occupational Licensing has winced and grimaced and rolled his eyes upward to the ceiling on some of the, and at different points, and hard to reflect that as part of the record, it's certainly part I've noticed, and for what little that might be worth, and I know you want to expedite the passage of this out, but I guess I'll join the uneasiness and uncertainty, and I won't. I'll shut up.
Thank you. And I don't give off the impression I'm trying to expedite this bill out of committee. I just don't know holding this bill over any longer will come to any different conclusion. So, but I think before any of us here on this committee is comfortable voting on this yea or nay on the floor, we're going to need to have some more comfort.
Representative Wark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know what the bill does either.
Well, I'm going to say that unless it's changed, that that's not in my experience with occupational licensing and how that they run their hearings is that they have all of the information, because that's when they're making a licensing or, you know, a disciplinary decision. So there's some kind of disconnect here between how my experience is that it's actually run and the good reasons for keeping the judges of the issue, you know, away from investigation functions. So I don't know. I joined the group.
Okay. Very good. Rissom Hawker.
Mr. Chairman, then with that closing commentary from all of us, I would be pleased to remove my objection to moving this bill from committee.
Okay. Any objections been removed? Any other objection? Not committee leaves, or bill leaves committee.
So I'm queasy and uneasy instead of being not cast or not read. Mr. Chair, I don't think I've ever seen this committee move a bill out with less enthusiasm.
Let's be the stellar staff. We'll take just a brief edit while we sign the sheet. Yeah.
Next bill up is House Bill 485. This bill was heard March 7, 2006. We took public testimony, closed public testimony. I did receive a copy of a letter sent to the Department Administration from Mr. Duncan, and the Department responded on 314 and responded to the committee members. Everyone should have a copy of the correspondence. We do have the following individuals here. If there are any questions, Mila Cosgrove with the Division of Personnel, Department of Administration, Art Chance with Labor Relations, Robin Wilson with the Tax Division, Janet Clark, Department of Hess, and Dave Williams with the Pioneer Homes. There are seven fiscal notes, which we can get to here in a little bit. So I think with that, why don't we just go ahead and open it to discussion and any questions that committee members may have, and then we'll address the new fiscal notes as we move along. Everybody on the committee is shy, so let me start. Mr. Duncan, do you want to come to the table here for a question or two? Duncan, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Off the top of my head here, I don't see the copy of the letter, but you submitted a letter to us requesting that what we're trying to do here be done through widening the classifications, I guess. Why don't you go ahead and briefly tell us what your letter said, and then did you see the letter or the response back from the administration?
Mr. Chairman, in fact, that's why I hope I can make some comments. The letter, you're referring to the letter of April 6th from Mr. Chance?
Yes.
Correct. As you'll note, I was not copied on that letter.
Okay.
Which always makes it difficult to see it.
All right.
However, I did get a copy of it just recently, so I had a brief opportunity to review it, and I was hoping I could respond. Since that questioned my testimony, I was hoping I could make some responses to that. I'd be very brief.
Sir, no, I'd like to hear your response, please.
But first, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to give me just a couple minutes here, and I will be very brief. And Mr. Chance's letter of 4-6, April 6th to you was not coming to me, so I was not aware of his comments at that time, and I found that unfortunate. He did say in there, in his letter, that my testimony clouded the main focus of House Bill 485. I appreciate that compliment. His letter also clouded the main focus of my testimony. I've known Mr. Chance very well. He can write cloudy language and did a very good job. Let me just make a couple points on his letter to clarify. First, I don't believe that moving positions from classified to exempt service violates the Constitution. Never said that. Don't believe that. I think it violates the intent, the spirit of the merit system that was in the Constitution. But clearly, they can be moved. It's not a violation of the Constitution. I also would make it clear that I understand probably better than maybe Mr. Chance, as a former member of the legislature, I understand the legislature can do almost anything they want to do if they pass a statute. So you do have the right to move positions from classified service to exempt service. However, there are a couple of constraints that I wanted to point out to you. First, and I'd ask you to consider this, and Mr. Chance's letter says there are provisions in our contract for moving of positions from our unit to other units or into exempt service. There is that provision, and that provision is done through the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. I don't quarrel with that. I do, however, take the position that passing a statute during a contract period to move positions from classified service to exempt service is a bill that does impair contract status. That to pass this legislation would impair a contract, and that's prohibited under the Alaska Constitution. So that the earliest that any transfer done legislatively could take place would be at the end of this contract term, which is June 30th of 07. And perhaps not even then, but at least June 30th of 07. I will say that perhaps it's been done before where legislation has been passed and positions have been moved, and I don't know why the union didn't object at that time. I wasn't there. I would have, and we will. Secondly, I think the real question here is, and I have not heard it yet, what is the policy reason? Is there a public policy reason to move the pharmacist and the revenue auditors into exempt service? And that has not been clearly enunciated as far as I can tell, and it's not been given. Or is it just that we need to pay those folks more? And I think that's the reason. And if we need to pay them more, I came forward with a proposal to work with the administration to put a pay plan into place that would allow us to do that. And I did write the letter that you have to Commissioner Nordstrand. Mr. Chance responded with an offer to meet. We did meet on March 29th or 30th, I don't recall the exact date, and discussed that. He indicated he would forward a proposal on to the commissioner. I talked to Mr. Chance today, and he said that's still under consideration, so we have not had a chance to resolve that issue. We are still working on it. So I would ask you to be very cautious not to move this legislation until we're able to resolve that issue on the pay plan, and also to be very cognizant of the fact that a statute that impairs contract does violate the Alaska Constitution. I'd also just remind you that if it's only the reason that you need to pay more, be prepared for a whole lot of other proposals come before you to move folks from classified service to exempt service so that they can be paid more. And that really does, that's why we have collective bargaining. So there can be a systematic way of putting together wages instead of doing it one group at a time and the legislature then facing the pressure of negotiating wages. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity you gave me this afternoon.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Questions?
Question. What was the problem with doing this from a legal your legal view, the legal problem?
That's right. Why, Rick, as you know, but clearly there is a process in our contract that allows positions to be moved from our bargaining unit to other bargaining units, or even to general, or even to exempt service, and that's done through the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, and it's a process that's in place. Other than that, our contract says that we, for the duration of that contract, represent all positions that are in the general government unit when that contract is signed. We do know that some can be moved in the process. To do the movement by statute, by passing a statute, violates our contract provision. And I'm sure you're aware that there is a prohibition in the Constitution that says contracts can't impair statutes and statutes can't impair a contract when it's in place. So my position is that if this is done statutorily, it violates our contract provision.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, what would be it seems to me the issue, is the main issue from a management view is we need to get these people hired and get going, and it's too cumbersome to do it classified, and what's the response to that?
Well, again, I guess the question is, what is the real reason? Is it to pay more? Then let's work on a pay plan under the collective bargaining agreement where you can pay more. If they need to fill these positions, there is a process that they could have started some time ago to fill positions and to advertise for those, and to come to us and say, we think we're going to have to pay more. Let's work to see if we can't reclassify these positions and do it under your pay plan or under an amended pay plan that I put together. I don't think anything is so critical that they have to move within the next 20 or 30 days to fill these positions. I believe we could work that process out.
And one final comment. Sorry, question. If the issue is to pay more and do it within the context of collective bargaining and arm's length transaction between the state and the union, is it possible simply to open up one category, one segment, just to address this particular issue?
My proposal to Mr. Chance, or to Mr. Nordstrand, and to Mr. Chance in our discussion was to look at our pay scale and just add a range 28, 29, and 30 to our pay plan. We only go to 27 now, 28, 29, and 30, base it on the same pay plan that we currently have. No current GGU member. We would not change any salary level. We would not increase any salary. We'd just be adding three levels of salary. And if there's money in exempt service to pay those folks, there should be the money to pay them if they're in classified service.
This point.
On that point, Representative
Harper. Just a point of clarification. When you open up the pay plan for this extended range, can that be restricted to certain jobs, or does that then open up the pay plan for everyone to that, that increased range? Are we essentially raising the salary bar here and sort of setting out a holy grail for everybody now that wants to get adjusted?
Well, they would still have to, Mr. Chairman, if I might, Representative Hawker, we would not be opening up the pay plan for any specific position. We'd be opening up the pay plan to add three ranges. So if it was necessary to find any class positions that might need to be paid more, that there would be the latitude, the flexibility to pay them beyond the range 27. Right now we're being told they need to be paid at a range 30 or something in the exempt service. Now there's the other hurdle to go through as to how do you classify these folks and the job classes and the families. And that's what I work with the administration on also. I think that does need to be reviewed also. I don't believe, for example, that comparing a revenue auditor, now the new title, forensic revenue auditor, whatever, the duties aren't much different than what a revenue auditor for is currently doing, comparing that with the budget analyst, and I have great respect for budget analysts, or with an accountant, that's a different level of work altogether, and I'm not sure should be a job class that you compare with. I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but clearly when you add those three ranges, any job class...
It's universal, yeah. Okay. I'll be honest, that creates more difficulty for me, because although just reading the tones of these letters, I've had some real problem with what I think is the belligerency on the part of the administration.
Mm-hmm. But likewise, I'm equally troubled with completely raising the ceiling across all potential job classifications.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, just be clear. I'm not advocating any pay increase for anybody in our unit. I'm not advocating that. I didn't come forward to you saying I think revenue auditors should be paid more or anyone else should be paid more. And we'll advocate for pay increases when we go to the table this coming December. That's our job there, to advocate for pay increases. All I'm saying is, if you want to pay those folks a higher rate in exempt service and you've gone through that process, you can also do that in classified service. Just give us the ranges to do that. If you're going to pay them in exempt service or classified service, it's the same money. It's just where they're located. Are they exempt or are they classified? So I'm not asking for pay increases for any of our members.
No, I appreciate that very much.
Nor am I asking any other members be reclassified into range 28, 29, or 30s.
I can see it coming, though. Yes, rightly so. That would be your job and personal responsibility to the people you represent.
Anything else, sir? Mr. Hawker?
Yeah, that conundrum. I came into this process today really thinking in terms more of, like I said, I've been particularly offended by, I think, the approach and the tenor I see in the administration's presentations, but the fact that it would be raising the entire bar across the board causes me, again, that does cause me issues, problems that can be addressed by going into an exempt structure for one or these defined positions that allows them, it's not going to be managed separately. So, just as in the bill previously heard, this is not one with a clear answer. I don't suppose you want to just sit on it for another day.
Let's move on here. Representative Petrullo.
If you did do it across the board, though, that's not an automatic. I mean, people have to go through a process to be determined whether they deserve it or not, and, I mean, that's a long, lengthy thing. That isn't going to just happen overnight, am I right?
Yes, and let me clarify that. Representative Hawker, the union does not determine of what ranges folks should be placed. That's a determination made by management, by the administration. So Representative Petrullo is correct. It doesn't automatically happen, nor would I go to the table next time and negotiate that certain positions should be at a range 28, 29, or 30, or 26, or 25, or anywhere. I do not negotiate ranges. I'll go to the table and negotiate everyone in every range should get a 10% pay increase, perhaps, right? But I don't negotiate what range they should be. So adding those three ranges to our salary plan will not cause more folks to go in there unless management wants them to. Not adding them there will not stop management from coming to you in next session or in a couple of weeks and saying, oops, we need biologists at a range 29 or 30. They need to be exempt. We need engineers. It's management who begins that discussion, not the union. So I'm not advocating that we'd be expanding or coming back to you saying more and more people need to be range 28s, 29s, or 30s. And I hope person do I answer.
No, that's what I understood, and that really helped clear it up. Thank you.
So basically what we're saying is we've reached a position where, like on the pharmacist on the bill before us, we've got the policy choice of either moving them out of exempt so we can increase their pay or creating additional pay ranges to move them up within the classified service. Is that? And would we need a separate bill to add those three positions? Is that a bargainable issue?
No, that really is bargainable, although we're not, and I used the word negotiation in my letter, and I didn't use that to mean that we're going to sit down at the table and negotiate. What I meant was I was going to sit down and talk with management to do that. My hope would be that if management would agree, we would sign a letter of agreement between the union. I would sign on behalf of the union and someone on behalf of the state, and then we would add three ranges to our pay plan. Okay. And it would be no monetary impact for you.
So really, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll come back to this to the other witnesses. Is this a good public policy decision to, every time we do this, when we're looking at specialized occupations or highly qualified or high-demand positions, do we always bump them out of exempt and deal them that way, or do we deal with them in the classified?
I think that's the crux of the issue. What is the public policy issue for moving them out of classified service? And so far, I have not heard the real public policy issue, the rationale for doing that, other than the fact we need to pay them more. If you need to pay them more, you can pay them more in classified service or in exempt service.
Okay, that's it.
Hawker, then I'll go to Kelly.
Okay, just a quick follow-up again, I think on the same one, Representative Weirock. I do not know the answer to this question. I'm sure there's hopefully an attorney here that can explain it. Is there anything that prevents us in the fact that, you know, we sit at this table writing law, scary as that might be some days, we sit here and write law. Is there anything that prevents us from crafting the law that would allow these additional salary ranges only in certain classified positions?
I would.
As a term of art, I shouldn't have said that, but so some of these defined job classifications.
Well, let me, if I understand the question, let me try to respond to that. I'm not an attorney either, but first of all, I think that's what you're doing when you pass a law putting them into exempt service. You're taking certain job classifications one at a time and saying they will be paid at a range X. That's what you're doing.
Moves them from your collective bargaining.
Move them from collective bargaining. It's not appropriate for you as a legislature to try to change our pay plan within our contract by legislation, because that's provided for under collective bargaining. It's a mandatory subject of bargaining.
Yeah.
So you can't change our pay plan because it's a mandatory subject of bargaining, and the legislature shouldn't be involved in that process, but you can put them into a different salary range by taking them into exempt service. Mm-hmm. And let me just say again, I caution you, I believe that if this is the road you start going down, there'll be no end to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative, you finish?
For now, yes, sir.
For now, okay. Representative Kelly.
Just a couple of points. I don't have much interest in adding pay grades between bargaining, between contract sessions, but I can see the problem you're talking about. This appears to be a matter of right to do this that you don't dispute, but you say if they do it, they can't have an effective date until such and such a time. So, but if I heard that correctly, I would like to hear from the AG folks. Is Mr. Duncan's interpretation of the law the way they see it? Because if it's a management right and they can get these people right on board, then that's one thing. If they're trying to get these people right on board but they can't do it till 2007, then we're probably wasting our time. And I don't have much interest in reaching in and adding three pay grades to accommodate something if it is a management right to do it, and if it could take effect quickly. And then you can clean it up at the next contract. But I'd like an answer to that question.
Yeah, I was going to have Art Chance or Robin or somebody come up and talk as soon as we were finished with Mr. Duncan.
If I could just very quickly, sure. And Representative Kelly, again, I appreciate your question. And I would not advocate that, in my discussion with Mr. Chance, if we're going to add three salary ranges to the salary schedule in our bargaining unit, it should be done for the supervisory bargaining unit. There's no reason, and to all other bargaining units, there's no reason why there should be an exempt salary schedule that has more ranges to it than a collective bargaining salary plan, pay plan. Let me just say, I can probably predict, let me put it that way, what answer you'll get from the Attorney General's office, because we probably will disagree. The real answer to that question will probably require us to use a process that we have available to us to challenge such a statute and such a change. And I don't want to go down that road, and I hope you wouldn't want us to go down that road either. That is time-consuming and it is not productive. But I believe it's clear in the Constitution that a statute cannot impair a contract. It's clear in our contract that when we signed that contract that we were the exclusive representatives for all those positions who are in the general government unit. It's clear in our contract that if those general government unit positions are to be moved, they are moved through a process that's specified in the contract that requires action by the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. It's clear that this is bypassing that and would be doing it by statute, which would impair our contract.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, who, the administration, Mr. Chance, is that you're the... They're all pointing to you, sir, so... You get the hot seat. Oh, good. Okay, you press some support. All right.
Joint authority.
Okay. So if you can tell us for the record who you are and who you represent, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. This is Mila Cosgrove. I'm the Director of the Division of Personnel for the State of Alaska.
Good afternoon, Art Chance, Director of Labor Relations.
Okay, I'm sure you've heard some of the discussion and some of the concerns, and I think we all got a copy of your latest letter in response to Mr. Duncan's letter. Representative Kelly has some questions. Okay. I don't think he wanted to buy donuts, so his cell phone was going off. Well, why don't we just open it up here to... first of all, I do have a question. Is time of the essence here? Because obviously what we've heard is that Mr. Duncan would like to have a little more time to work with both of you and try and do, you know, work it out so that we can keep these employees as classified employees. On the other hand, we don't have a whole lot of time in this session. So if something needs to be done, we need to do it probably today. So I'd like to get your opinion of that.
Mr. Chair, I'm really not the one to ask. The public policy decision to make these people exempt was made by the managers of the Department of Health and Social and the Department of Revenue to go forward doing it this way. So they're the ones who know how important it is to them. I would think it is quite important, or they wouldn't have done it, but I'd let them speak to it. For me, it's just a matter of how I do it, not whether it's done.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, because I think I do have a little bit of insight into the issues that are facing the departments, they are facing significant recruitment and retention difficulties with pharmacists and corporate income tax auditors. And while I'm sure that we'll hear from them, I can verify through hard data that what they're telling you anecdotally exists in reality. They cannot recruit people and pay them at the wages that are currently associated in the classified pay plan and accomplish their missions.
Okay. Very good. Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This debate, as I thought, if we boil down to case A, case B, we're pitting two sides against each other. Do we have actually a false dilemma here? And I'm thinking in terms of both pharmacists and high-grade accountants are in short demand. They're independent. They're typically independent, or they certainly have a very large independent element of the profession. Is there anything that would, in order to meet our state needs, is there anything that would prevent us from go out and hiring folks on a contract services basis rather than making them employees either within the collective bargaining unit or in an exempt position at this time?
If I may, I can answer that fairly specifically. As I understand it, there are specific prohibitions related to the pharmacy. On that standpoint, the head pharmacist has to be an employee of the organization that's hiring them. And you can verify that with the Department of Health and Social Services, but that's my understanding. So while they do employ contract pharmacists to sort of pinch hit for them, so to speak, that's not a realistic long-term solution. They can't operate effectively in that manner. They also operate supervising state employees, and it's a bad business practice to have contractors supervising state employees. I just don't think that that's a workable solution. You have some similar issues also with the corporate income tax auditors, so to speak.
I spent my life as a contractor being hired to supervise a company's employees and bring them on and train them, so I would respectfully disagree with the claim that it's bad business practice.
With all due respect, we have run into issues with that in the state system, and it's something that we generally try to avoid. And I appreciate your comments on that.
But then, is it A, B, or C? Is it not possible? Is it possible as a immediate solution on the table to the need for these positions while we let y'all and the bargaining representatives sort out a longer term solution?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawker, I suspect one thing that might be able to get a more enthusiastic opposition from Mr. Duncan than putting them in the exempt service, because there at least he has some opportunity to try to organize them or recruit them to a union, would be to contract out for them. I mean, pretty well known, we've had lots of disputes with lots of unions over contracting out for work. At minimum, it would be a long grind involving arbitration, perhaps the labor relations agency, and perhaps the courts. There's specific, fundamentally, his labor agreement and most of our others would only countenance contracting out for a service on a feasibility study demonstrating the cost savings by doing it. Could we do it? I don't know. But certainly there are as many, if not more, collective bargaining impediments to contracting out for it as there are for
moving it to the exempt service, which is fundamentally, this is one thing I agree with Jim on. This is mostly a public policy question. Once that public policy question is answered, then there are some collective bargaining and personnel questions, but fundamentally whether or not a position or a classification is in the exempt service is a question of public policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Representative Kelly.
Well, I'm sorry, I had to step out for a second. Art, did you answer if you did, I won't ask you to repeat it. Did you answer the question I had about whether, A, this is a management right to do it the way you want, and B, whether you could do it immediately, or if you have to wait till 2007?
I did not, and I will try. At least within the understandings that we've developed, I'm not an attorney either, but I work with them a lot and hire some.
And maybe just to, on that point, Mr. Chairman, if all we do is get you and Jim with opposing opinions, that probably won't help us, so we probably would still need legal to tell us. But I
can tell you what we've done in the past. We even did some of it when Jim was commissioner of administration. There's express language in that contract that says vacant positions we can move however we please. We would certainly take the position that whatever his contract says, when they're vacant, if their status changes, either their bargaining unit designation, perhaps they acquire supervisory duties, or perhaps they're made exempt, which has happened in the past. It's also happened the other way. We've taken exempt employees, made them classified, and moved them into his unit. But we would take the position that we have a pure right in contract to move an empty position, whereupon ASEA could then petition the Labor Relations Agency to put them back in their unit or to say they are a part of their unit. We would, and I'll admit it right out front, we would oppose that because the general government unit's definition is classified in non-supervisory employees of the executive branch, and the fact that they're not classified, they are exempt, would mean that we would take the position they should not be in the general government unit because they have a different body of legal rights. But that's up to the ALGA to decide. The vacant positions, there's a valid question, and I don't think it's ever been answered by a court on either the contract, and the closest the court in my tenure has come to addressing that is anything related to future employment's more an expectation than anything else, and that goes back to some of the disputes in the 80s over changing the 40-hour work weeks and that sort of thing. The ALRO would have to answer, and it has not ever answered, whether or not there's what's known in the private sector as a contract bar that keeps you from doing things like this during the term of a contract. We have moved them, and they have gone to ALRO, and ALRO has countenanced it during the term of a contract. So is there a firm answer? If by that it is meant that a court has given us black letter law, it's never been answered. We think we know. I think Jim thinks he knows. I think we're right and Jim's wrong, but you know, that's the way those things work.
So if you got the you think you have a management right and you think you can do it right away, that'll accomplish what you're trying to do. Then there may be an arm wrestle over it, but that's what you think.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, we think you have the management right. Okay, we think if you look at the case I cited in the letter, the Zerbitz case, the Supreme Court said the legislature has chosen for whatever reason, those are their words, to put a position in the exempt service. If that is done, then we believe we have the we're confident we have the management's right to move any vacant positions, and most of these are vacant, any vacant positions at that time. There's some question, there might be a pretty good arm wrestle, and I'm not sure the answer, I'll admit that, on what happens with filled positions, which have real people on them.
Thank you, Mr. Representative
Couture.
Thank you. So, if you get the wage increase, no matter if they're in the bargaining unit or not, you get the wage increase, that solves the problem, wouldn't it? I mean, isn't that what you're mostly concerned about with these positions?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Curtula, it's not quite as simple as that. Ultimately, yes, we need to find some way to effectively pay individuals so we can compete in the open market.
A couple of points, though, that I wanted to bring up that relate to that question. First of all, with the pharmacists, they're primarily in the supervisory unit and not represented by Mr. Duncan, and therefore any issues extended to his union would have to be extended to the supervisory union as well. But classified employees are covered under the State Personnel Act. They're classified and subject to the state classification plan, which has all kinds of very mundane intricacies to it, and I won't bore you with all the details here. But as the director of personnel, I'm not free to take a position and just say, oh, you should be classified at this range. It's actually based on a set of criteria. If I apply those set of criteria to pharmacists, they are accurately classified and assigned to the salary range that they're currently at. So I don't have a lot of latitude to say, oh, just because I'm having recruitment difficulties, I can move them up. I may be able to do something across a whole group, and we are working on that. But truthfully, the group that pharmacists belong to, I don't have the same recruitment and retention difficulties. So I'm either artificially jumping up a lot of positions, seven salary ranges, which is a huge jump, and not necessarily warranted from a business perspective, nor necessarily supported by our pay policies, or I can try to target and isolate the specific individual problem for which there is precedence. If you look at the exempt statute, there are other medical professional classifications that are exempted, and my guess is for a lot of the same reasons. It's hard to subject to them the normal classification factors. And to some extent, that is also true of the various very highest level of the auditors as well. So, yes, we need to pay them more. I am not convinced that we can do it within the classification plan, and thus our support to move these limited group of positions into the exempt service. Representative Petula, I don't know if I've answered your question or not.
You answered it from your perspective. Thanks. Yes.
Okay, Representative Warwick.
Just on the if you've got the positions that you've got to deal with here and you just simply slide them over to exempt, then you're still dealing with the same issue, isn't it? You're still dealing with, well, you have to pay them more in order to attract them, and you have to advertise, and you have to recruit them. They're just subject to less restrictive hire fire sort of terms. Is that correct? They're out of the classified and into the exempt. You really saved anything other than moving these positions?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Wyrock, yes, to some extent that is correct. Exempt positions are exempt from the State Personnel Act and the policy, the pay schedule, so you have greater flexibility about where to place them. And yes, you're less restrictive in terms of hiring and to some extent their tenure as well, although I would submit if you're having recruitment and retention difficulties, you're not going to capriciously let someone go in an area where you're having a hard time finding qualified people. And obviously you have to have good qualifications in order to do the work that's been outlined. I mean, you have to be licensed as a pharmacist to be one.
You're not encumbered by the collective bargaining agreement that they would normally be under now.
You're correct. They would not be subject to the provisions of the collective bargaining agreement unless they organize those particular group of individuals.
Anything else, Representative Jewell?
I'm just wondering if they're exempt, do they run the risk of being let go by any new administration?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Yeah. I tried to address that somewhat in the letter I wrote. There's a huge mythology about exempt status. We have lots of unionized employees who are exempt. All the maritime, all the vessel employees, marine highway system employees are all exempt. They're exempt because of the peculiar means by which they were hired at that time. That they were placed in Section 110 of the State Personnel Act because they were being hired out of Seattle hiring halls, and they didn't want to have to deal with Alaska Register System, so they just exempted them from the State Personnel Act. Teachers were exempted from the State Personnel Act, probably because they concluded that they had a greater body of rights under Title 14 than they did under the State Personnel Act. there are most of the positions, and there's a long list. I don't remember how many. I remember that Marine Highway employees are pairing 16, but there's 20 or more, and they've done a lot more. It's been much amended. People have been in and out of exempt. But most of them are, as Mila alluded to, there are people that are so far removed from that standardized run of state employees that can be encompassed in ranges 5 through 30 that you cannot pay them in that scale without totally distorting that scale. The psychiatrist and some of our medical doctors and petroleum inspectors and some of those kinds of people. There's a homogeneity to most of the state workforce that can fit in these integrated pay plans, and the State Personnel Act does require the words are an integrated system of pay administration that provides for career progression. It's from the State Personnel Act's preambulatory language. There are some kinds of jobs that simply don't fit into that homogenous workforce, and most of the positions you'll see in that long list of exempt positions are people you just can't pay as a part of that homogenous scheme. And to Representative Curtula's point, I think it was her question, or Representative Jules, about them, their status of being released by a new administration, there's almost no at-will employee in this state, period. I mean, you can't just, division directors, special assistants, people who come under the partially exempt service, you can say we don't need your services anymore. Anybody else, you're going to have some kind of cause and be prepared to prove it.
Representative Kelly.
Isn't it also true that if as Mila said, if you have these people in this other category and somehow they got racked around, they could be organized as well?
Sure. The statute says whether or not in the classified service they can be organized. And as I said, we have lots of unionized exempt employees.
Thank you.
On that point,
Representative Jewell.
How many people do you need to organize?
Representative Jewell. The definition's at section 090 of PARA, and it says a community of interest must be demonstrated. We've got bargaining units with as little as, I think, 22 now. There is no numerical limit. There must be a demonstrated community of interest. So that's some question of fact for the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, but it's not a function of numbers.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I do have some questions on the fiscal notes themselves, but I don't know if you want individual departments to talk about them or if you guys...
Individual departments.
Anybody but me.
All right. Let's see. There's like 7 of them, if I recall. Okay, let's see here. The first fiscal note was with the Department of Commerce, and there was no changes. Fiscal note for the department number 2 was Department of Revenue. The one dated April 11th replaces the fiscal note number 2. Is that correct? Somebody just shake your head, okay. Fiscal note for the Department of Corrections, there's no changes, so we just want to adopt fiscal note number 3 on that. Fiscal note, Department of Health Social Services for the Pioneer Homes, the one dated 4/11 replaces the old fiscal note number 4, correct? Okay. Fiscal note Department of Health Human Services, Health Care Services, the one dated again 4/11/06 replaces fiscal note number 5. Okay. And the one for Health Human Services, Behavioral Health, dated 4/11/06 replaces fiscal note number 6. And then fiscal note HESS, Public Health, dated 4/11/06 replaces fiscal note number 7. Is that correct? Okay. Is there any questions on the fiscal notes? Any questions at all for Mr. Chance, Mr. Duncan, Representative Chenault?
Mr. Chairman, I would probably make one comment on every one of these fiscal notes. All of them are 0 for this year, but all of them are indeterminate for the following years out. And I think each one of them basically say it's indeterminate that either division or API, whichever one they relate to, it's indeterminate whether they will need funding for these different positions into the future, and I would say that you can expect that they will need funding into the future, so you can expect a fiscal note, not this year, but in the out years, that this is going to cost more money, not that it that we may not need to do this, but just the note that it will cost more money. Less for your capital budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that.
And just looking out for you.
We went to Kenai projects, right?
Not a problem. I don't have any in there, I don't believe.
All right. Well, and I guess my comment would be that the reason why we set this aside like we had was in hopes that we could get some kind of agreement between the union and the administration, and that we could do this through the process and the collective bargaining process. Obviously, that didn't work. Not to say that it won't still work, but if we're going to take any action on this, we need to do it today or relatively soon. So with that caveat, I'm at a point here where I think this bill should move on in hopes that the administration and the union folks will continue to work on this issue. I don't think we're talking too many employees in this particular case, but this could lead to other classifications also trying to get the same status. So I think this needs additional time and discussion. So with that, Representative Foster?
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move out the Finance Committee HB 485 with the attached fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
And if I might address the objection, is I heard something a little different than perhaps you heard. What I heard was that there's no clear answer to this. I heard both sides say that if the approach proposed in this bill is taken,
Somebody set me up. I got donuts tomorrow, guys.
But I got my cell phone number. All right, sorry.
What I heard from both sides was that there will be litigation. The issue would be settled in litigation. I'm not comfortable setting us up for a litigious approach to this. I guess that'd be why I heard something a little different. That could be, if it was dealt with raising the classifications within the existing, the relevant bargaining units, that would accomplish the same goal. And I think that's a second order. Accomplish the same goal without an assured course of litigation, and I tend to be litigation averse where it's possible. So in this case, I'm not endorsing the position taken by labor in this, but I am setting my own policy of saying I'd rather take the least risk averse course.
Okay, appreciate that. Any other comments? Okay. Yeah, just in case you haven't figured it out by now, if your cell phone goes off, you have to buy donuts the next day. So. Come back tomorrow. I'll have donuts. Okay. Madam Secretary.
I'm sorry, I got in late. Is there a motion before us?
Yes. Representative Foster made a motion to move this bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
Representative Hawker?
No, ma'am.
Representative Holm?
Yes.
Representative Jewell?
No.
Representative Kelly?
Yes.
Representative Curtula?
No.
Representative Moses?
No.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Weirach? Representative Foster?
Yes.
And Representative Chenault?
Yes.
Representative Meyer?
Yes.
Six in favor and five against.
Okay, the bill barely passes out of the Finance Committee. Thank you all for your time. Thank you, everyone from the Ministry. Yes, Richard.
Just a comment. I have to sort of attach myself to the concerns raised by Representative Chenault here. We've fired a gun, and we haven't seen this smoke or heard the shot yet, and it's going to come back.
It's coming.
And so I'm quite concerned about from that perspective.
Appreciate that.
Sure. Okay, thank you, everyone from the administration, from the labor unions for joining us this afternoon. Maybe we can move on to...
So I guess I should have stayed lost for a while.
You called me on my cell phone, didn't you? Did you do that?
No.
Just the little one.
My cell phone's at home. I lost
my wife
somewhere.
We've been married for years. We're getting a fight with tomorrow. She's really like this.
Yeah, it's probably too bad.
She'd tell me a bunch of
this is precious people.
She's coming with smiles. I'm pulling up.
I thought her game was here just a library.
We're in a good mood one day.
I was down there. I couldn't do the other thing. My sick mother was going to call. I was worried about her being in the hospital. With life and death.
Okay, let's go on. Let's go on to an easier bill, hopefully. House Bill 475, Public Employee... House Bill 447, Broadcasting... Okay. We're still meeting here, guys. House Bill 447, Broadcasting Promoting Charitable Gaming. Craig Johnson, staff to representing Liesl McGuire, is going to introduce the bill to us. Mr. Johnson, go ahead. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Craig Johnson. I am staff to Representative Liesl McGuire. Before you today is HB 447, and this is a bill which basically levels the playing field between broadcast advertising and what is currently exercised with the print media, and that is the advertising of legally accepted and totally legal activities which involve raffles and lotteries. In your packets, there were some examples of advertisements that appeared in the local Anchorage paper within the last week. They're commonplace. You'll see there's stuff in there from all kinds of different charities. I think the Sportsman Show had a raffle to raffle off a firearm. Those kind of things cannot be advertised on radio or television. It is an FCC rule that says the local communities will dictate whether or not they can be advertised. Most other states allow this type of advertising. Alaska, because of this particular statute, prohibits it. This does not in any form or fashion increase the amount of gaming that's going on. It will allow certain charities to kind of drive their own boat and be allowed to handle their own license and advertise everything from hockey raffles to my Rotary Club, which does sell machines. Online, we have Dennis Bookie, who is with the Broadcast Association, and also in the audience, we have Jeff Prather, who is with the Department of Revenue and is the gaming guru, for lack of a better term, to answer any specific questions about what this does. I can't emphasize enough that we're talking about a fairness bill that allows radio and TV to do the very same things that happen every day in newspaper.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Representative Weirich?
Yeah, Mr. Johnson, why do we need the words other than animal classics in this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Weirich, that was an amendment that was added in the Labor and Commerce Committee. There was one of the members of that committee particularly took offense to some of the ads that were airing in local TV stations regarding animal classics that were happening. That was a function of a bill passed earlier in a previous session that allowed that to happen. So it was kind of a personal front of a
point of order.
He didn't like
it. Chairman.
Yeah, what's your point?
Well, I was a sponsor of an animal classic bill. It did not allow the advertising. I just resent the implication that my bill allowed advertising. And I don't want to go down that road. I wanted to stop it before we got very far. I want to make it real clear on the record. The bill that I passed on behalf of the Palmer Elks did not provide for advertising. And that was some other loophole that existed elsewhere.
And that's fair enough. I don't think you were referring to
that. And if I apologize if that was to be inferred. I don't think that was the bill. I think it was a result of some loopholes of some previous
action that, that this particular member found he didn't particularly care for. So,
okay, go ahead with your questioning, Representative Warwick.
Well, we have an Eddie's.
Sure, Eddie's.
There's been a lot of accusations. Okay.
Did you have any other questions? Okay. Representative Hawker, did you have a question, sir?
I was just following up on Representative Wyrox. I was had the same question that was previously asked.
Okay. Right. Any other questions for the sponsor? We do have, let's see, we have, is it Mr. Prather? Is that correct? With the Department of Revenue? Okay.
Tax Division.
With the Revenue Gaming Group, if there's any questions for him. Yes, sir. Otherwise, if there's no other questions, let's go ahead and go take public testimony. Our first person online here is Rick Schmidt. I'm sorry. We have somebody with time constraint. I'm sorry, Rick. Let me go to Vicki, and then we'll go right back to you, Rick.
Okay. All right. They didn't unmute me fast enough here.
Okay. Vicki Music. Music.
Yeah, I'm from Ketchikan. Thank you for hearing our testimony today. I'll make it really quick. Basically, everything that Mr. Johnson has already stated is our platform. We're looking to level the playing field between ourselves, broadcasters, and the media. Also, the notion that these nonprofits that are seeking to raise money, they are not gambling institutions. These are make a lot of money off the residents of our state. They're just trying to raise money for good causes like foreign exchange programs and Rotary. So we just want to give them more of an ability to raise money for their own interests. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Vicki. Okay, Rick, let's go back to you. Rick Schmidt.
Hello?
Rick? Yeah, Rick, you there? Okay, if you can, try to get as close as you can to the microphone so we don't need to turn up the volume on this end. Go ahead, Rick.
Okay, I just wanted to say thank you very much for hearing this, and thank you to the chair and members, and also hi to my next-door neighbor, Richard Foster.
Richard.
Rick, I wanted to go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, go ahead and tell us what I had talked to you last year about this, and Rick runs a radio station up there, and he's also, I think, at various times ahead of the Nome Chamber of Commerce or the Rotary Club or the Lions, and they've always got raffles helping the needy and food banks and stuff like that, and he can't air any of them, so maybe he can make a few comments on that.
Yeah, it is very difficult. In fact, we just had a gentleman who found out that one of the native community here has got cancer and was looking to raise funds. The A&B Club was doing that. And we gave him a whole bag full of stuff from the station here, but we couldn't advertise the raffle. I mean, our hands are tied, and if there's room in the paper and if they have the gumption to give that for free, they can do that. They do it rarely here, and most of the time it's paid. And I guess I just take a line out of Jerry Maguire and just say, help us help them. That's basically what we're talking about, just another avenue to help our nonprofits. VFW came to me several years ago, needed some money desperately, had a little raffle idea, and I'd tell them that I couldn't do it. You know, within a few years, we're sending folks off to Iraq at the same haul, and it just seems really unfair. It's a very unbalanced playing field right now.
Okay. Any questions, Representative Foster?
Oh, I'm sorry. One of the best bills I've ever seen.
Representative Stoltz has a question.
Thank you. Is it Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. I believe you testified on a Calcutta bill last year, if I recall. I have a question. It's the approach that you've talked about is you want to do some charitable and philanthropic work, but there appear to be other people here that within this they want to use it as a revenue source.
It could be a revenue source. I don't anticipating it to be a big one. Myself, if I were in a larger community, or even maybe a smaller one, if I wanted to target a certain audience at a certain time and had to pay 10 or 15 bucks to do it, I'd do that, especially if you're generating increased revenues for your nonprofit or whatever issue you're trying to take care of in your community to make it a better place to live. But we're not talking about a lot of money, and sometimes the space is kind of scarce during certain prime times, and it may be a way to kind of shoehorn yourself in to get your message out. But again, I don't think we're talking about a whole lot of money, and it would put us on the same playing field. I personally am the treasurer for our local Rotary Club. When we do our Rotary Duck Race, where we put ducks in the water, they're numbered. We sell tickets to match those numbers, and the first three ducks and a wild duck that comes out of the water wins, and we've basically been raising for about 30 years now funds for four scholarships each year. They're continuing scholarships for all 4 years of college, and to be able to advertise for that and do that, I have to go to the paper, and I ask her if she'll give us free space, and she says no, and I have to pay for it. That's what it is. If she were to have space at a certain time, she might give it to me. But I know it's going to be valuable. I know if I spend $250 for an ad in the newspaper here, I'm going to generate a lot more money than that. In comparison, if you were to spend it on a few spots here in Nome, not that we would charge you for it, but if you did, that might be 10 or 15 bucks. So you kind of have to take a look at the scale and see that if you're going to be on an even playing field, it should be even.
Paul? No, thank you.
Okay. President Schnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, was it? I'm sorry.
Rick.
Hey, Rick. Do you guys do public service messages? And are you allowed to say, for instance, in the cancer victim that you have, that that there's a fundraiser going on for this person, and that you know, it's going to happen such and such night at such and such place?
Not if there's a raffle. We can't mention it at all.
You can't mention it at all, or you can't mention the raffle at all?
Can't mention the raffle. And what we do is, we don't want to crowd that line too much. We don't want to. We don't even appear to. We got a status in the community. I don't even begin to go there. So I try to make up for it by giving them as much stuff as possible, hoping that will help them raise the funds. But you know, it may be technically we may be able to do that, but I'm not going to test that line.
Okay.
Anything else for Mr. Schmidt? Mr. Schmidt, thank you for joining us from Nome this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thank you and the chair and committee members for all your fine work. I appreciate it, and thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
All right, moving on now to Dennis Bokey. Bokey.
Yes, sir.
Bokey.
Bokey. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dennis Bookie. I manage six of Morris Communications radio stations in Anchorage, and I'm also an investor in two of the small commercial radio stations in Kodiak. I'll just pretty much ditto everything everybody has said, and we have to tell nonprofit organizations every day that we can't air their requests, although it's something broadcasters typically do. The other thing to remember is that a lot of times these gaming events are part of a bigger event, and like Rick said, it gets real gray when you can talk about that event and when you cannot. It's a legal thing, allowed and permitted in the state of Alaska, and print can do it. Broadcasters can't. Doesn't seem right. It seems a simple thing to fix. And the last thing to just add here is, as broadcasters, we're not asking to expand gaming or change the legislature's approach to gaming in any way, shape, or form. Whatever that this body thinks should be done with gaming, that's fine with us. We just want the promotion of it and all medias to be equal.
Okay. We do have a question for you, Mr. Bookie. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'm not understanding the dynamic of advertising. Presumably you advertise to increase activity or participation, so wouldn't that be expanding the level of gambling? Or if advertising does work as it's purported to?
It could help increase the funds going to nonprofit organizations in this state. Yes, it could do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, but that's not expanding gambling. I mean, you seem to... Presumably, it's to increase the level of gaming activity, and we, you know, this talks about the raffles and permits, but it also we're talking about bingo halls and lotteries as well, which is I we'll leave it at that. I think the gentleman's answered it the way he wants to answer it.
Okay. Very good. Then no other questions. Let's call on Stuart White.
Okay, hello. Thank you very much for your time. Yes, I'm here in Ketchikan. I'm a representative of KFMJ Radio, and I also am involved with a couple of nonprofit organizations myself. And, yeah, as pretty much everyone has said, we're looking for a level playing field, and also I have the similar situation that came up at our station a year or two ago regarding the Rotary Duck Race. They wanted to run the PSAs for their event on our station, and because it is a raffle event, we were not allowed to do that, and that has soured the relationship with that group since then, would be, I guess, the best way to put it. One of the things that I did want to make also mention was that one of the reasons for this is to allow, in allowing a level playing field, it allows these groups with their raffles and other charitable events like that to have the options open to them whether they want to pay for have their ads run or have it run for free. And so they could have it run as a free PSA, but one of the issues with that being that those also could run at some of the worst times of day, including the overnights. And what good is it going to do someone to have something running at 3 in the morning?
Okay. Question, Brett Foster.
Yeah, Rick is still there.
as I understand it, there's only two stations in Nome, KICY and KNOM, and KICY can accept paid advertising, but I don't. Can KNOM? In other words, even if you ran these, you're not getting anything out of it. You're just doing it as a public service for like a food bank or Cub Scouts or something. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct, through the chair, Richard. It's absolutely correct. And I think if you broke it down and saw what the potential might be to make money for these stations, it wouldn't be much. But for us personally, we would do it as a PSA. And we work hand in hand with the folks across town, as you'll find most of the broadcasters do. We're very competitive when it comes time on the commercial side, but very cooperative when it comes time for the public interest and all the peoples of the state of Alaska. Since we cover such a large area, communications is absolutely critical. And we're definitely a part of that. We're a part of the community, and we just like to participate as such. That basically is, I mean, we would not make any money out of it. Some would make a little bit, possibly. Not much, I would think. But most of all, the people would be served, and the folks who are in nonprofits would be helped down.
Anything else, Representative Foster? Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. White. Was there anyone else online who wanted to testify? Seeing and hearing no one. Anyone here in Juneau? Seeing no one. So we'll go ahead and close the public testimony. Is there any more questions or discussion about the bill? So, Representative Stoltz.
I'd like to ask some questions to Mr. Prather.
Okay, Mr. Prather, please.
Mr. Chairman, Jeff Prather. I'm the Gaming Group Supervisor in the Department of Revenue.
Okay, welcome. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Prather, as I read the bill, this comes directly from the charities, the purveyors, not the operator. So the percent would come out of the 30% that the charities get. Is that a correct reading?
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, you understand there's a division of allocation. There's a guaranteed amount for charities and charitable gaming under...
through the expense limitation?
Yeah.
Yeah, this would have no impact on the expense limitation. The charities would make the same regardless.
Okay. I had a question, Mr. Chairman. What? I see satellite in here and some other technologies. Would this allow any kind of interactive type gaming potentially?
My reading of it is that this would simply allow raffles to be promoted over the radio and television, and that's it.
Mr. Chairman, your familiarity with gaming, a lot of things expand over the years. It's been real tough to draft a simple gaming measure. And you don't see any possibility of any kind of interactive... I've talked to a few folks that that might be a possibility.
Representative Stoltz, I don't see that.
Okay.
Anything else?
Yeah, I'll stop for now.
This may be it.
Unless
somebody else has some questions.
Well, I can pretty much.
We'll come back to you.
Go ahead.
Have you had any analysis done of the problem on the inequitable treatment between print and broadcast and the constitutional issue that raises?
No.
Do you have any opinion of that? Have you looked at any of the cases or no?
No, we haven't, Representative Turtle.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can count. That's fine.
I think this has been a day of bills that we haven't really felt too crazy about any of them, but again, unless there's...
This one the least, though.
Huh? This one the least?
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead and say so.
I have a lot of sympathy for doing the PSA and for the charitables and raffles. I belong to fraternals and service clubs, and
bought a lot of those little plastic ducks that float down the Meadow Creek as a rotary fundraiser over the years. And that's the benign part that I'm happy to go along with. And but I see this as I'm just really cautious about how we deal with gambling and gaming, and it's always becomes wider. I was just doing a simple little bill for the Elks, and it certainly would that make about $12,000 to $15,000 a year. It was for Tula's hometown and being an Elk, and that was my goal. And working with the Department of Revenue and the Department of Law, they crafted the language that opened it up for another person, and that's been the controversy involved. And I thought were pretty good and pure intents. And you know, I've had, you know, been called an inept legislator and careless in my dealing with gaming. So it's you know, after you get branded by that by the critics in the alcohol industry as well as the Anchorage Daily News editorial, it really makes you a little gun shy on gaming measures. Quite frankly, it's I see a lot of possibilities for this gambling open. You don't hire one of the top flight lobbyists down here if it's if you just want to do some free PSAs. I have total sympathy with Representative. That's not where the issue. That's not where the revenues are going to be. I'm worried about charities. We've done so much reform in charitable gaming over the years, getting politics out of it, getting lobbying out of it, making sure there's a fair distribution for charities. And now I don't want to see a radio and TV war of these guys. It's hard enough for charities to get placed on it with a permittee with an operator to get fair treatment. And now you'll have this, you're going to have operators and bingo halls running ad agencies potentially. You know, I just hate to see potentially more and more dollars coming out. And it's as advertising works, it's supposed to increase the level of gaming. It's it doesn't allow bingo advertising, but you run a split the pot raffle with a big prize, give away color TVs, you name it. You're going to use that to draw people in. I think the guy that found the loophole advertising under the other provision, he advertised his buffet, and then his I guess it ran for a while before I saw it. I mean, it's, I don't think that was the intent of the legislature. And we're talking about, we've talked to some really great broadcasters at what they want to do, duck races and do food bank fundraisers, but really they if this was really what it was about, you wouldn't have an organization hiring a lobbyist to push it through. And I'm not trying to, the sponsor is a very good person. I trust her motives on trying to get through a bill that's going to be good for the types of things that Representative Foster has talked about. But I'm just really leery of loopholes and what we open up every time we deal with gaming legislation. I've been burned by it as well. And it's once burnt, then shy of the flame. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll let the committee proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Any other questions, comments on the bill before we accept the motion? Representative Hawker?
Actually, if it would be in order, respectfully, I'm going to take a different approach to the bill. I think it's, frankly, a very good bill. What's legal in this state ought to be able to be advertised. With apologies, and to you, sir, as chairman, I'm running very short staff this week because I have staff with family situations that have left me without aides for a while here. So apologies. I do not have a written amendment, but I'd like to offer a simple amendment, conceptual and verbal.
Okay.
And so,
if it's simple, we can do it conceptual.
Yes, sir. I move an amendment number one that would, on page one, line seven, remove the other than animal classics language.
Okay. Conceptual number one removes on line seven, other than animal classics. Any objections? Okay, same one. Conceptual number one is adopted. Any other amendment? Representative Stoltz?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer conceptual amendment number two on page one, on, I think it'd be line eight, insert. If the broadcasting is limited to public service announcements provided free of charge to the permittee by the broadcaster.
That's It's a pretty big conceptual amendment.
No objection to the amendment, sir.
If you've accepted it. I don't know if you've accepted the amendment as in order.
It's a pretty big amendment for a conceptual amendment, I'm afraid.
What would be the...
Can we call it very brief at ease?
Yeah, let's call it brief at ease so you can write it in.
Mark will take us.
One has been typed up and distributed. Amendment 2. Conceptual Amendment 1 passed, yeah. Conceptual Amendment number 2, Representative Stoltz.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I will offer the amendment, move the amendment, allow it to be objected to.
And I will object, sir.
And, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to air my concerns. I don't want to gut the sponsor's bill. It's clearly the Broadcasters Association has their, which this would basically do. But it would also be more in line with what I think is a more appropriate intent for broadcasting on gaming. And I just wanted to publicly, more publicly and more covertly, overtly air my concerns. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to withdraw this amendment with my concerns noted.
Okay. I appreciate the, and I apologize
for the time spent, but it's important.
No, I want, ideally it's nice if we're all comfortable with bills that go out of this committee, which today I'm not sure. I want every committee member to have time to air out their concerns and their thoughts. So I appreciate you withdrawing your amendment. Okay, so we have the bill back to force as amended with conceptual amendment number 1. Any other amendments to be made? Don't think. The fiscal note is 0. Okay. With that, what?
We'll hear from the sponsor about the amendment.
The amendment was withdrawn.
No, the First Amendment.
First Amendment? Okay. That one passed, though.
Right.
Well,
I guess we can. Yes.
Don't help me, Craig.
It's too late, Craig.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, on the First Amendment, I don't think the Palmer Elks will be spending any money advertising, given they only make $12,000 to $15,000. Everybody knows they're out at the Alaska State Fair every year during the State Fair.
Flagrant advertising.
Right about midway.
Representative Foster.
It'll be legal soon.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move on. HB 447 out of committee with individual recommendations, as amended with individual recommendations.
Then I'll object, just for purpose of discussion, because it's a weird day and it's almost a full moon. I don't know what else you can
say.
Representative Weirich.
I just want, this struck me as an odd bill when I saw it. I said, why is this even necessary? Because the same concerns that Representative Stoltz has about radio seems to also equally apply to newspaper, wouldn't it? I mean, the whole notion that you can advertise one medium but not another one, either it's in for a penny, in for a pound, and so I just thought it seemed appropriate to support this, so I will withdraw my objection.
Okay, good point. All right, okay, you remove your objection, any other objection?
We're all anxious to go home,
okay,
I think.
Seeing none. All right. The bill passes committee. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. It's almost 4 o'clock. I think that we probably, I know a lot of you are here for the PERS and TERS issue. And I would like to, I was hoping maybe to at least get the Representative Seaton to kind of give us an orientation, but I'm afraid
that's going to take you a while.
Representative Seaton.
Because he took out the
sorry?
He just took out
the he did his foot in the door. You know.
Okay, well, we only have one bill in the morning, so why don't we take you up second after Representative Stoltz has a bill, and then we'll take up yours. And we can carry it over into the afternoon if need to be. And again, I apologize. I hope to at least get started on that. One thing I will say about this bill, House Bill 475, is that I really do not want to revisit Senate Bill 141 when we discuss this. I want to keep just to the guts and the topic of 475 itself. And maybe it's best we are waiting until tomorrow, because today was a strange day and we could have gone anywhere with that one. So, is there anything else to come before the committee? Let's see. Just to see what we're doing tomorrow is Wednesday. House Bill 390, property assessment appeal fee.
will come up first, and we'll take up this bill, 475, and then again we'll meet in the afternoon at 1:30, and we have two on the schedule, 399, House Bill 399, Elder Fraud and Assistance. I believe that's the co-chairman's. Are you ready? Okay. And House Bill 470, Mandatory Use of Headlights. So those are the only four bills we have scheduled for tomorrow. With that, if there's nothing else coming for the committee, we're adjourned till 8:30 tomorrow. Or, I'm sorry, do we... I don't think we're adjourned.
We're
adjourned. Okay, yeah, because we don't have 8:30 scheduled. So we're recessed until 8:30 tomorrow.